From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 10th day of January 2020. It's USDA Report Day. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll go through the numbers released by the United States Department of Agriculture with Mike Zuzlo. He's at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas, and Lance Honig, who is the chief of the crops branch at USDA and responsible for putting today's crop production and grain stocks figures together will join us to explain why he went back and changed last year's, the 2018 acreage, what that meant for the reports today and potentially going forward. We'll do all of that right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
I hear the numbers as they finished up in Chicago. Corn futures were up about 2.5 cents. March at 385 and three quarters. May at 392 and three quarters. Next year's December at 402 and three quarters. Soybeans were a penny to 2 cents higher. Jan up at 935. The March at 946. And the July at 971. Next year's November at 974 and three quarters. Wheat futures about a quarter, 2.25 higher in the March at 564.5. Live cattle futures around 70 cents higher for the day. Feeders up 67.5 cents. And lean hogs 22.5 cents higher on the afternoon. We're now joined by Mike Zuzlo. He's at Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting out of Atchison, Kansas, to discuss this morning's USDA crop production and grain stocks report, the wheat seedings report, and a couple of others as well. Hey, good afternoon to you. Quite a day it was at 11 o'clock today.
Helps explain why the trade earlier in the week, when we had such a big run-up in the crude oil and the metals because of the Mideast tensions, why the agriculture market for the most part, Todd, just remained unmoved for the most part, because they knew there was going to be such a large USDA data dump today and that we were going to have to wade through some pretty heavy numbers. And USDA did not disappoint us. They came in with some real curveballs. They came in with some real fine analysis. And I think, probably for me, the headline thing from a long-term perspective, something that I've been wishing for and talking to you about for 5.5 years, is when will we get the wheat off our back as a feed grain? And the second lowest winter wheat planting acres that they put out today would suggest, along with pretty tough crop conditions in the hard red wheat belt, that we'll be tight enough in domestic supply demand come next July when we harvest winter wheat. We should be in a situation where the wheat is more of a friend to the corn instead of a foe and a thorn in its side.
So USDA did a couple of changes today, and we'll hear from Lance Honig, who's the chief of the crops branch, in just a few minutes. They did go back and change some things from last year. Acreage was adjusted. Did that make sense to you?
In fact, that's what I had put that in my weekend copy and my pre-report analysis, that it would make more sense to me as a statistician or a person that works with statistics a lot to go after what you know more about. And you know more about the unharvested acres out there as opposed to the yield. Why the yield went up, I question, but I questioned it for about 10 minutes because the news wires pushed out a story at about a half an hour after the crop report came out and said, look, USDA is going to resurvey farmers and unharvested corn and bean acres in five key states. They're going to revise potentially all their estimates from today on U.S. corn, soybean acreage, yield, production, and stocks as far as later this spring, which that doesn't surprise me. We will probably see some fresh information come out on the baseline projections and their big Washington, D.C. Meeting that they'll come up here in about a month, and then they'll probably go take that all the way into the March acreage numbers and maybe even all the way into the May supply demand. We'll be dealing with this last year's crop, but I like the fact that they are going to do this. I wish they would have reported that before the actual report came out on Friday, because I think it would have soothed and eased a lot of nerves by a lot of producers out there.
Yeah, because I talked to Lance Honig at 1 o'clock. You are exactly right. It's quite likely that the survey updates won't show up until we get the May WASD figures, and so that'll be interesting to watch. He says that's when in 09-10, that's about the time that happened, and it all depends on when farmers are able to get into the field in North Dakota and South Dakota, Michigan and Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Those are the five states that will be surveyed again. What were your takeaways from this morning, and what are you telling producers this weekend?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think the trade really went into this report like they do a lot of reports. They were long beans and short corn, and I don't think the market was rewarded with USDA's crop report. And you look at the grain stocks even, the quarterly grain stocks were on the high end for the beans as opposed to the corn and the wheat. You look at the winter wheat seedings that I talked about. You look at the global ending stocks, the corn stocks to use ratios, Todd. The great unsung hero out there that the market doesn't want to price in yet is the fact we're still sitting at a five-year low in corn stocks to use and at 26%. And I think that's going to have to come due pretty soon, because there's several of our competitors and several countries that typically import a lot from us. I think they're going to need a lot more than normal, i.e. Mexico, as far as needing more from us. And when it comes to Argentina's corn production, I think that the trade's already starting to sniff out the idea that maybe the beans are there, but it's going to be hard for the corn to be there. So I think the trade was long beans, short corn. I wonder if they're not going to have to revisit that after this week's numbers, and especially after we get the U.S.-China signatures put on paper for the Phase 1 trade deal. I think that alone will help me figure out whether the trade has got a premium already built into the beans, because they believed the U.S.-China trade deal when it came to soybeans, but they didn't necessarily believe it in the corn, which I think that's a fair assessment.
Hey, so given all of that, and given how beans are marketed, they tend to come to the market earlier. USDA did raise the midpoint to $9 on beans. You think that's looking backwards as opposed to looking forward then?
I do. Yeah, unless we would miss a couple key rains in Brazil over the next 7 days and go backwards in their crop. They've made headway. I've taken my production number up to 120.5 million tons for Brazil's production. Anything over 120 million tons, I'm going to assume, is export ready and ready to compete with the United States with or without a trade deal, because I just think that's good risk management for the clients I work with. So when I see almost a 980 November bean price again this week compared to a $4 corn price, and I see they're almost 2.5 times the price of Dease corn, you can't ignore that. So I'll be on kind of a high alert next week to see follow through to the upside, led by the meal market, which is trying to give a technical buy signal.
Can wheat, come back to this for the last thing in maybe 30 or 40 seconds here, can wheat lift the rest of the market up?
Yes, it can. I think that the wheat market and the corn market together can do a really good job of lifting the market up, because I'm assuming that if the wheat goes higher from here, both weather and the currency markets are improving in terms of the commodity outlook overall, i.e. USMCA and the Phase 1 trade deal. Markets start to see better demand instead of a demand that gets hit.
Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Todd.
That's Mike Zuzlow. He's with globalanalytics.biz. On this Friday, Eric Snodgrass now joins us to take a look at the weather forecast. Hey, thanks so much. I hear you're doing the Top Farmer conference at Purdue today. That should be a great one. I suspect you'll be telling them something about South American weather. What's on your plate?
Yeah, that'll be a main focal point. And it's kind of a strange deal out of South America this year. You know, we hear about some local problems in certain places. So, for example, eastern Brazil overall had a drier start to the growing season, but you wouldn't look at it and say it was a disaster, but compared to a year ago, it doesn't look quite as good. Same with kind of parts of southern Brazil. We went through some time periods of hot, dry weather, but then, you know, when it comes to precipitation and growing crops, it's all about timing. So if you get the rain back and it, you know, the plant is there to survive it, it will. So, you know, what we're looking at in the near term is that things right now in Mato Grosso, where they're trying to get that first crop out, is looking halfway decent because they're drier in the near term. What they don't want to do is they don't want to turn wet at the end of this month and at the beginning of February. That'll be the real big push to get a crop out of Mato Grosso. And there are some hints that that may happen. So we may hear about some reports of some slowdown in the progress of the harvest coming out of Brazil's northern growing region. When it comes to Argentina, you know, it's again, talking to a guy this morning who is down there looking at things, and he says, you know, overall, we're having a halfway decent year. The most productive areas are getting the rain when they need to get it, and it's the more marginal ground that are having problems. So just like in the U.S., we tend to focus on, you know, those highest producing regions. And so that's kind of the main story I'm going to deliver. I'll say this about corn prices in Brazil right now. Locally, they're really supportive to go after big Safrina corn crops. So I think they're going to want to get this first crop of beans out and out fast. So we'll be talking about that today over here in Purdue.
I'll bet you'll get asked about the rainfall that's coming across our state probably as well. What's that look like over the weekend?
Yeah, so it's already began, and we're going to continue to have pretty wet go of it for the next 24, maybe not 36 hours. And it's going to be mostly a rain event where we are. But, you know, starting later on tonight, getting into tomorrow, we do need to be on the lookout for some ice in the northern and western parts of the state. And then that actually extends up to Michigan as well. And then following all that, it's going to be some decent snows. So parts of Wisconsin, but also parts of Iowa may have the potential for grabbing 6, 8, 9 inches of snow. So they're looking for, some of the white stuff to come down. But we're too far to the south here. And we're in the warm sector, and we're gonna get some rain out of this one. Quite a bit. We may end up the weekend with a couple of inches, some locations maybe over 3. So it's a soaker.
I heard that the line was kind of Quincy to Chicago as the center point. Does that remain the same?
Yeah, it does. And it's going to be a real tough way to find exactly where that line is going to be. And by the way, if you don't get the snow you want this weekend, I got 3 more systems lined up over the next 15 days that are going to try to come right back through the same path. So our 15-day forecast time period is one that's quite active and also quite wet.
Hey, wait a second, because we've been warmer than that. Or is the pattern changing to cooler temperatures?
Well, you're right about the warmth. Going back 20, 25 days or so, we have been very, very warm. In fact, we've had a stretch of days here where we haven't seen a below average temperature. That I do think will change, but not in the near term. You're in the northern plains. Oh, it's going to be just ridiculously cold. Canadian Prairies cold. Montana, very, very cold. But there's this dividing line that kind of runs from, let's call it the Panhandle, Oklahoma, Texas Creek to Maine. And if you're south and east of that, it's a warm forecast. And that may break down by the time we get, I don't know, maybe to the 20th, 21st, 22nd of the month, where we actually get a decent shot at some cooler air. But right now, nothing's really advertising for that to stick around for, I'm talking, 10 or 15 days where we're below average for a long time. So, it seems as though this moderate pattern continues as we carry out the rest of the way through the month of January.
Have you gotten your crystal ball out yet and taken a peek into the springtime?
Oh, yeah. I'll look at it as often as I can. And I'll tell you what people are going to be discussing, and that is we've had pretty far throughout this growing season, we've got a pretty strong subtropical jet stream. All right, so the name of the game will be once we get past the coldest time of year, which will likely happen sometime in February, okay, we're probably going to get polar vortex disruption and get a real nasty cold snap. What I want to know if that subtropical jet stream remains to be strong. If it does, that would tell us that the southeast, the mid-south, getting the Ohio River Valley, could continue on to a wet spring. If that's the case, we will be looking again at what could be tighter planting windows. I think with the market's, memory of 2019, if there's any sort of a tight planting window there, that could be favorable for prices. But if for some reason that forecast busts and we do get, a good warm, dry spell at the end of April and beginning of May, and we're able to crank on getting a crop in, I think the markets will forget 2019 pretty fast. At least that's my take on it right now, if you ask me to stare into a crystal ball.
All right. Hey, well, we'll keep up with you, and you'll keep gazing forward. We'll see what you see. Hey, hey, thanks so much. I appreciate it, and have a good day there at Purdue.
All right. Thank you.
That, of course, is Eric Snodgrass. He is with Agrible and Nutrien Ag Solutions. Well, let's turn our attention now directly to this morning's USDA crop production report, the grain stocks numbers as well. The chief of the crops branch at USDA, NASS, is here. He's responsible for a couple of those reports. His name is Lance Honig. Hey, thanks, Lance, for taking the time out of a really busy day today. I hope you made it through lockup okay.
Yeah, survived another one, Todd. And, it's a long process and makes for a long day, but you know, it's important information, and we want to do everything we can to make sure that everybody gets it at exactly the same time, and that's what lockup's all about.
Yeah, so this is as unique a crop production report, certainly a final crop production report, as I can remember. I bet you've been asked this a couple of times, but because USDA NASS went back and changed a couple of numbers from last year, planted area, obviously harvested area then as well, and even yield, that changed the balance sheet for the World Agricultural Supply and Demand estimates. Can you tell me where that first data came from that caused you to make the changes?
Well, that's right. And so, you know, much like we do with soybeans every year, when the marketing season was over, we went back and took a look at the balance sheet. And of course, that wrapped up back in September. But we've been looking at the balance sheet for corn, because our revision process is currently set up in a different time frame. The opportunity, we have a schedule set up when everything happens, when estimates come out. And we do that so that everybody knows when they can expect things and when not to expect things. But this was our what we would call an open revision period for the previous season's corn. So we looked at that balance sheet, and really the biggest thing that stood out was that really large feed-in residual that's implied by the numbers that were in there, larger than we've seen historically. And so we went back and looked at all of our data. We looked at acres, yield, production, stocks, you know, ending stocks, looking at where we could, you know, possibly make some adjustments and still stay within the data that we have. And now knowing something that we didn't know earlier, and that's what that entire balance sheet looked like at the end of the season. So based on that review, we determined that we could make some adjustments to planted and harvested acres for the 18 corn crop. We did not move yield, but lowering the acres brought the production down. And then we went back and took a look at the September 1 stocks as well, the ending stocks, and said, where can we make some adjustments there? Again, staying within the data that we have. And we had an opportunity there to increase the stocks there just a bit as well. And overall, that got us into a little bit better, what we would consider a little bit better feed and residual situation.
How did you get to the point where you were off? And I have a follow-up question as it relates to the stocks as well. But how did you get to this situation where it wasn't correct?
Well, and, you know, I don't know if correct is even necessarily the right word. There's, you know, there's some... You're subject to some interpretation on that feed and residual. It's not measured. But knowing, as you look at that over time, that we saw an implied feed and residual number that was larger than we'd seen in the past, you look at current livestock inventory levels, that doesn't really jive. And so we felt that it was important to make some adjustments to bring that more in line with what we think really makes more sense.
The stocks number... the final one for the year, the September one, has been kind of sacrosanct. And it's the feed and residual in the following reports that generally makes up the difference. Why'd you decide to do it the opposite way this time around?
Well, I mean, we're only responsible for the production and the stocks when it comes to the balance sheet. And, of course, you know, the balance sheet itself publishes in the WASD report. Our friends down in the World Board work through that. And a lot of the items in that balance sheet that they're responsible for are measured amounts, imports, exports, even a lot of the ethanol use and things of that nature. But at the end of the day, based on what comes in and what we've measured going out, any difference is going to be a combination of feed use and other items, and hence the feed and residual, and that's not a measured amount. And so historically we haven't made adjustments to try to bring that number too much into alignment. It does vary from year to year, but again, this year was different. We just saw a value higher than we had seen, and again, knowing kind of where inventories are at on livestock and, you know, the whole situation, we felt it really warranted a second look on the numbers that feed into that. We found some room where we could make some adjustments and thought that was the best thing to do, and so that's what we did.
Am I correct in recalling that going forward, your intent at USDA is to have the September corn ending stocks number be more of a balanced number like the soybean number is balanced at the end of the year?
Well, as I mentioned, we've got these defined revision periods for, you know, dealing with the previous year's crop. And for soybeans, that defined period is in September. For corn, it's in January. And I think that, you know, we're certainly leaning toward moving that open period for corn into September at the same time as soybeans. And, of course, that's when we get the ending stocks, which is effectively the last piece of the puzzle for the balance sheet for the year. So it could allow us to be a little bit more timely in making any adjustments that we need to make. Or if we don't need to make adjustments, then at least closing the door on that earlier as well.
Yeah, that was my question. Is this year an anomaly, or is it the setup for coming years that you might be making adjustments into January on a more regular basis?
Well, you know, it's impossible to say for sure because we evaluate every year as it comes. But, I mean, certainly this year shows that we are receptive, you know, to making changes when we feel that's necessary. But, yeah, we'll just have to see what next year brings. And, you know, as I said, the timing might be a little bit different as we might shift that up into September instead of January. But we'll just have to see how the year unfolds.
An announcement came out from USDA NAS not long after the reports were released that a survey, well, that you would recontact those people who had responded as it related to acreage and harvested in five, I think, states. They were South Dakota, North Dakota, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan. I think those are the right states.
Yeah, that's
right. Sometime this spring, correct? Trying to get a handle on the crop that's still standing and what that harvest looks like?
Yeah, that's right. So when we did the survey back in early December, you know, and we asked producers not only to report for all their acres already harvested and to be harvested, we zeroed in on specifically the acres that were still left to be harvested. And for corn nationwide, about 8% of those acres were still standing in the field. For soybeans, about 2%, quite a bit higher than what we'd see in a normal year. And that's not a surprise to anybody, I don't think. So what we'll do is we'll go back later this spring. We'll go back to those same producers who told us they still had acres left to be harvested in those states that you mentioned. And we'll find out what actually happened specifically on those acres. We'll determine, do we need to make any adjustments based on the new information we get? If so, we'll publish it at that time. And of course, the question is, what is that time? And as of right now, we don't have an answer for that because we need to see when farmers are able to actually get back into the fields and finish harvest. So we'll see what, you know, the winter brings. The last time we had to do this was back in 2010 for the 2009 crop, so spring of 2010. In that particular year, up in that part of the country, we were able to publish updates in May. But will this year, you know, unfold like that year did in the winter? I don't know. So we'll make that determination a bit later on. Once we know, we'll make sure we get a notification out there so folks know what to expect and when to expect it.
For that standing corn crop, producers gave you a yield number. I take it probably that USDA NAS also has a calculation for loss. Can you tell me a little bit about that data and how it worked into the grain stocks figure?
Well, again, as far as the data itself, as I mentioned, we have a section in the survey form itself that asks specifically about those acres, not just how many there are, but we ask the producer to tell us what their expected yield is on those acres in particular. So that is really the driving force behind determining what kind of adjustment needs to be made based on those acres. Their opinion of what the yield is going to be is probably the best information that's out there on those acres. We do have some experience based on the past, but again, this is a rare occurrence. As I said, 2010 for the 9 crop, that was the last time we did this. And, you know, not necessarily the same crop today as it even was back then. So you've got to be a little bit careful about making too many assumptions. But no matter what, no matter how many acres there are or what year it is, any time we have acres still standing for harvest in December, it's part of the on-farm stocks total. This year was no exception. You know, the only difference was there were more of those acres and therefore a few more bushels of unharvested production rolling over into the on-farm stocks total.
So you said 8% of the corn still standing, correct?
That is correct.
Got an idea what the yield on that 8% is?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? And when we say 8%, that was at the time of the interview. And, you know, there were, and that's nationwide. So that includes states beyond the five that we're resurveying in. Obviously, we're focusing on these five states, number one, because they have the largest proportion or the largest number of acres still out there standing. And number two, you know, a lot of the other areas where they still had acres standing when we surveyed them, they actually were able to get those harvested shortly thereafter. Therefore, the impact, you know, not nearly as extensive. We're really concerned about finding out what happens with the acres that are going to stand out there all winter. And that's where you've got the most potential, I think, for, you know, change to occur. You know, is it more than we already predicted? That's what we need to go back and find out. And so we'll do that, and we'll just see where we go from there.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right, appreciate it, Todd.
That's Lance Honig. He's the chief of the crops branch at USDA NAS. Don't forget that our Commodity Week program was live this afternoon to air at our home station. Should be up online by about 4 o'clock this afternoon at willag.org. Our panelists to discuss this morning's USDA reports and all the things that might entail include Jackie Vakes of Total Farm Marketing from agmarket.net, Matt Bennett and Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Ag Marketing. You can check it out online right now, well, pretty soon anyway, at willag.org. Look for Commodity Week. It's our weekly look at what's happened in the world of agriculture. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.